Welcome back. And yeah, it's really great to see so many of us here in the Shrine Room again on Saturday afternoon. It's absolutely lovely. So Sudhajaya said earlier on, following on from last month's launch of this class, this afternoon we're really kind of launching the kind of program that we're going to be following over the next 6 months or so. And as you may be aware before you came, or if you weren't aware before you came in here, it's kind of probably a bit obvious now, with the images on the shrine, that we're going to be focusing on the mandala of the five female Buddhas over the next 6 months or so, or as they're sometimes known, the pranyas. And pranya is a Sanskrit feminine noun meaning wisdom. And I'll say a little bit more about that in a few moments. So each month in the class, we're going to be focusing on a different female Buddha, taking one at a time and exploring them in a bit more detail. But what I want to do today is to just give you a kind of overview of the pranyas and help to try and situate them, I think, in a kind of perhaps a wider kind of context of Dharmic practice, so that we can kind of understand their relevance or start to explore their relevance, maybe, to us as women, as female practitioners living in this kind of very modern, westernized 21st century society. So I'm going to talk probably for about 30 minutes, hopefully a little less, but we'll see how I go on. And then there's going to be just a short opportunity this month just to get into pairs and just to kind of talk about your initial response to maybe what I've said, to the figures on the shrine, what you feel about them. And it's nothing we're going to be feeding back into the group, so just kind of feel free to kind of say whatever you want. And then, as Sudhajaya said, we'll conclude with a mantra. And you can make offerings at that point to the shrine if you want to.
Sorry, there seems to be like an audio hum. Am I being, can other people hear it?
Yeah. An audio hum?
Yeah, there's like this audio sort of electronic hum going on.
Is that the air conditioning?
Yeah.
Yeah. Does somebody want to turn it off and
see if that makes a difference?
Yes. Is that it? You're sitting right next to it, so it's going to be really bad. Thanks for pointing that out. Sorry, I didn't see your hand up there. Okay, so that's what I'm going to do. But before I start, I really want to express my gratitude to Vasantra. Some of you may know who Vasantra is, others of you may not. Vasantra is a senior male order member within Tri Ratna, who has gone to a great deal of effort over the years to help to bring to our attention these female Buddhas. So perhaps unlike their male counterparts, the five Yinas, which some of you may be familiar with, these female Buddhas have throughout the history of Buddhism, not just kind of within Tri Ratna at all, but out the kind of history, global history of Buddhism, have in general been overlooked, neglected, perhaps not seen as significant in comparison to the mandala of the male Buddhas. And the probable exception to that is Greentara, who many of you will probably be familiar with as a kind of female figure, as a female Buddha. Now, there are many reasons and conditions and debates around why that is so that kind of help to explain that neglect. I'm not going to go into those at all today. You'll be perhaps pleased to know, I don't know. Maybe we'll get into those another time. Suffice to say that Vasantra, a number of years ago, he went on a years-long solitary retreat, and during that retreat, he spent his time reflecting on these female figures, and he has subsequently shared his insights and practices with us in Tri Ratna, and he's done that through writing about them. He's done it around through visualization practices, giving visualization practices on these different female Buddhas, and also in writing pujas. And I, for one, am extremely grateful for that. Indeed, I wouldn't be giving this talk today if it wasn't for Vasantra. I'm drawing very heavily on his material, but also I kind of know how much these Buddhas, particularly Kandalavasana, has informed my own practice. So I am very kind of grateful to Vasantra for that. And I think probably another order member that I need to kind of thank right at the moment, another male order member, is Kumada, who's an order member based in Bristol. And he's actually painted these images. And he kind of painted them based on kind of Vasantra's work. And if you ever go down to Bristol Buddhist Centre, the actual kind of full-size paintings are down there. So he has painted these, and so we have these available now. And I think looking at those images, there's a very kind of contemporary feel to them. I'm just going to introduce you to them very briefly, but I'm going to talk about each of them later in more detail, just so in case you don't know their names. So starting from my side, so we have Lochana down here. Then we have Marmaki, the yellow one. In the middle we have Akasha Dalteshwari, then we have Pandavasini, the red one, and then at the end we have Green Tala, the green one. fairly obvious. So if we look at those images there on the shrine, and there's some cards down the front as well, so if you come up later and make offerings you can actually have a look at them as well. I always kind of get a sense when I look at these that there's quite a contemporary feel to the depiction of these female Buddhas. However, despite their kind of contemporary feel, it's fairly obvious that on the surface, at any rate, these figures are neither of our time, nor do they come from the dominant culture of this society. They come from the kind of Indo-Tibetan tradition, and play a very important part in the kind of highest tantra. And without going into lots of detail, because I don't think I could go into lots of detail, at this level of tantra, Buddhas are often represented in a sexual embrace. So there's a kind of male-female sexual embrace, what the Tibetans have called yab-yum. Some of you might be familiar with that. So this kind of yab-yum father-mother form. Now, I think when we're kind of reflecting on that, what's really important in some respects is that we don't simply lay our kind of contemporary understanding of gender onto this kind of yab-yum image. Instead, it might be more useful to see them as these two different figures, as two aspects of one figure. So in a yab-yum figure, the female represents the wisdom aspect of the enlightened experience. Hence, they're referred to as the panyas, which I talked about at the beginning. So they represent the wisdom of the Buddha. The male symbolises the methods or the skillful means through which that wisdom is kind of compassionately expressed in the world. However, although there is that kind of distinction that exists there, I think we all would kind of recognise, we all know, that whether we identify as a male or female or neither, we need both wisdom and compassion. Wisdom and action. And we need both of those. So it makes more sense when I kind of think about these, to see them as two aspects of one figure rather than kind of separating them out. However, what that does show is, or indicate, is that very clearly these female figures, these pranyas, are connected with the mandala of the five female Buddhas, of which many of you are probably much more familiar with. And when I kind of actually introduce each of the figures towards the end, I'll actually tell you which male Buddha they were connected to. However, similar to their male counterparts, they don't represent actual historical figures that kind of lived and walked on this earth, but they are figures that appeared in the meditations of very experienced, very advanced male and female practitioners living in the East a long time ago. So, given their historical, their cultural specificity, you might say, it might seem kind of apt to ask, well, what relevance do they have for us? Looking around the room, diverse group of women living in the West in the 21st century. And I think in order to kind of try and answer that question or kind of tease something out that might begin to answer that question, kind of need to move beyond the specificities and instead explore the nature of our minds. So, as we all know, we all have an everyday mundane mind that gets us through the kind of daily activities of lives, of our lives. It gets us up in the morning and gets us to our jobs or wherever we're going. It got us here this afternoon. We were probably very aware of it when we were meditating. I certainly was very aware of my kind of mundane surface mind this afternoon, probably going over what I was going to say right now. So we have this everyday mundane mind, and at one level we really need that. We really kind of need that to be able to kind of do things. However, even if we are very new to meditation, as perhaps some of you are here today, new to meditation, new to Buddhism, we know that our mundane mind is only, I love this phrase from Vasantri, he talks about it being only the tip of the iceberg of our consciousness. I just love that kind of image of the iceberg with everything else that's kind of underneath it. So there's kind of a depth to our consciousness that probably for most of the time we are simply unaware of in the day-to-day kind of living our lives. And it's, you know, it's that depth that we're trying to access through meditation. And kind of a Sutra urges us that if we can kind of access these kind of unconscious depths, what we will discover is a kind of like amazing kind of treasure chest of powerful and meaningful symbols, which Jung refers to as archetypes. So from a Jungian perspective, archetype simply means a kind of mental image that's been kind of inherited from the kind of earliest human ancestors, and a kind of at some level represent or present in the collective unconscious. And Buddhism teaches us, so one of the reasons for our suffering, one of the reasons for our kind of continual dissatisfaction with life, is that we are out of touch with these kind of deeper archetypal forces in our minds. Or it may be the case that we occasionally, we kind of catch glimpses of them, but we might not be fully aware of their meaning or of their power to actually kind of radically transform our lives for the better. However, through meditation, through reflection, maybe ritual, we can start to kind of access, to open up to these kind of archetypal forces with hopefully greater regularity over time and with practice. And they can start to kind of influence and transform our lives. So, in short, reflection on these archetypal female Buddhas on the shrine today, or indeed any archetypal images of this nature, can help us to access the kind of deeper recesses of our consciousness. And this is really important because in our everyday, modern, busy world, we have few means of making direct, positive contact with these archetypal forces. However, we, sitting here right now, I kind of think are incredibly fortunate because we have all come in contact with Buddhism, we have all come in contact with the Dharma, and we have a wonderful opportunity to come into contact with these archetypal forces, to open ourselves up to their transformative power. I have a quote from Vasantia which I kind of just love. It keeps kind of playing around in my mind at the moment because to me it kind of just kind of brings together kind of different aspects of our mind, the kind of rational with something much deeper and underneath that. And he's talking about Buddhism and he says, Buddhism combines very clear rational teaching about the nature of life and the mind with powerful methods of meditation and ritual to transform the depths of consciousness. And to me, I just love that. I find that kind of quite exciting. And I think that partly what Vasantra is saying here is that this idea of universal archetypes is very important, particularly if perhaps we have some resistance to connecting with figures that on a kind of mundane level at any rate may not be from our cultural background or our current time. We might not kind of see what we might have in common with them. However, I would kind of invite you at the women's class on an adventure to kind of set aside our kind of cultural conditioning and to kind of see these figures as universal figures, universal archetypes of the mind, rather than culturally specific and perhaps irrelevant figures. And it's important to remember that these figures have emerged from a level of human experience that kind of transcends those kind of socially constructed boundaries and dichotomies that we've kind of layered onto our daily life. And if we can just open ourselves up to the possibility that these figures come from the deep levels of our own minds, we can kind of begin to see how contemplation of them might help us to contact that kind of rich potential of our own minds. And I don't know about you, but I kind of find that quite exciting prospect. Okay. So far, much of what I've said about archetypes and so forth is equally applicable to the forms of the Buddha that appear in the male form. So we might ask, well, why reflect on figures that appear in a female form? Is it necessary? Why not just kind of reflect on the Buddhas that appear in a male form? I think in some respects, it's totally unnecessary. And it would be equally fine to just reflect on the mandala of the five male Buddhas, not even consider their female counterparts. And of course, at a kind of transcendental level, gender doesn't exist. So it kind of wouldn't matter anyway. There's no female-female kind of dichotomy. However, definitely speaking for myself, most of us, I think, for a lot of the time in our life, do not live on a transcendental plane, and if you do, then I applaud you. But instead have our feet kind of firmly planted in the kind of mundane world where gender, albeit a kind of social construct, is alive and kicking and has a kind of impact on our daily lives and informs our experience of life. And I think this is one of the key reasons why I think it's important that we at least are aware of these female Buddhas. And going further than that, for some of us, and I would certainly include myself in this, female embodiments of enlightenment might have, do have, a particular resonance for us as women. And maybe it's something you want to kind of reflect on when you discuss in pairs. So I kind of think as women growing up, living in this westernised society, I think we can often feel a lack or we can feel impoverished when it comes to, I think for the want of a better term, female role models. And I think this is no less the case in Buddhism as it is in other areas of our life. And I think reflecting on, meditating on, bringing into our consciousness these female figures might be one way of counteracting this. And of course we're counteracting this kind of invisibility at the most important, at the highest level of all, because all these female figures embody different qualities of the enlightened mind. Hence they're powerful, symbolic, archetypal reminders that we are capable of enlightenment, capable of awakening to the true nature of reality, and we're capable of doing that in a female form. And remember, while I'm talking about these kind of female figures as archetypes, we are at a fundamental level dealing with living forces. And quoting from Dasancho again, he says, we are dealing with our deepest and most sacred potential as human beings, our capacity to develop beyond all suffering and to become ourselves embodiments of love, compassion, wisdom, and freedom. So these female figures, alongside the more familiar male figures, represent the potential of our own minds at its deepest level, at a level that is beyond that mundane mind that I was talking about at the beginning. And I think one way of understanding this is through the many Buddhist stories told of people who believe they are poor when in actual fact they are rich. And I was kind of thinking about this, I was reflecting that my own private preceptor, Shuba, who many of you know, in accounting for why she gave me my name Mahamani, which means she who has the great and precious jewel, alludes to one of these stories, which some of you may be familiar with, and I'm just going to kind of very briefly tell you it, because I think it illustrates the point I'm making very well. So this is the story of the man, but it could have been a woman, who gets drunk and stays the night at a friend's house. See, it could have been a woman. And during the night, and unbeknown to the drunken man, his friend sews a precious jewel into the hem of his coat. Man gets up in the morning, goes off and carries on with his life, and he spends many years through trials and tribulations trying to kind of eke out a living for himself. And it's only when he has a chance meeting many years later with this friend that his friend says, and don't you know that you have this precious jewel in your coat, that he realizes that he has these riches. And I think those stories are wonderful kind of metaphors for our own situation. We all have the riches of enlightenment as a potential within our own mind. That is, we all have a precious jewel. But because most of us generally don't go beyond the surface level of our experience, we spend most of our lives feeling impoverished, like the drunken man. And perhaps we wander from one situation to another, trying to find things that make us happy, whether that's job or career or relationships or different religions, different Buddhist groups, whatever it is. We're kind of continually kind of searching. And we don't necessarily know, we're not aware that we have what we truly need within us. We have the jewel sewn into our coat. And we don't necessarily discover that until it's brought to our attention. And for us that might be lots of different ways. We're all here, we've all kind of come here on a journey, on a path. So coming here to the centre, or maybe learning to meditate, coming in contact with the Dharma, maybe reflecting on the female Buddhas on the shrine. Of all ways that we can kind of come into contact with that vision, in some respects, that jewel. Of course, when we come into contact with that vision and we recognise what it is, it's really kind of up to us what we do with it. But we need to remember that these deep, these rich levels of the mind are always there, even if we haven't kind of quite discovered them fully yet. So a lovely way of kind of thinking about these kind of archetypal female Buddhas, these pranyas, maybe are as messengers. We can see them as messengers from the kind of deepest levels of our mind, coming to give us a sense of the kind of vast riches within us. And if we kind of truly open ourselves up to them, to our deep, rich potential, we can, I believe, kind of radically transform ourselves until we can become truly identified with the love, the compassion, the peace, the freedom embodied in these figures. And I think it's always really important to remember that one of the key aspects of Buddhism is that we become what we turn our minds to. Okay, I'm coming near to a close. You'll be pleased to say a few more minutes. So I just want to move on that and just very briefly introduce each of these figures. I'm only going to say a few words about each of them because we're going to be going in much more detail over the next few months. So at this end, the blue, light blue figure is Lochana. So Lochana is traditionally in the east, blue figure, and she's associated with, connected to the blue Buddha Akshobhya. And Lochana means she with the eye and is associated with mirror-like wisdom. So when you experience this type of wisdom, your mind reflects everything perfectly clearly. There's a clarity there without any kind of subjective distortions. So, like a mirror, your mind isn't clinging or avoiding any experience. So it's not kind of pushing or pulling away. It's not being kind of swung about by craving or aversion. So in some ways it becomes like a very still pond or lake. It's still, calm and unwavering. So that's Lochana. Next we have Mamaki, yellow. It's in the south, is yellow and is associated with Ratnasambhava. So Mamaki means mind maker. And I don't mean mines as in the mines underground. What I mean is that she feels for all living beings as though they were her own children. They were her own self. So they are all hers. Hence the term mind maker. So if you possess her wisdom, you feel that everything is mine. And when you feel that way, you feel for everybody. thus there develops a kind of wisdom of equality. So Malmaki sees the kind of common factor in all experiences. She sees that all experiences, all phenomena, are empty. They're empty of any inherently existing selfhood. So all things in many ways are just appearances of the mind arising and disappearing as conditions change. Going to the other side at the moment, to Pandavarsini. Pandavarsini is in the west and is red, the strong, powerful red there, and associated with Amitabha. And her name means the white-robed one. And this is because of the associations for what it feels like to be in a kind of, in the fourth dhyana, or a kind of a deep meditative state. And in this state, your mind is so positive, so clear, so concentrated, that its influence kind of radiates outwards and can kind of positively affect your environment and other people. So she expresses something of this kind of meditative experience. She also embodies discriminating wisdom. So this is the other side of the coin for Malmaki's kind of wisdom of equality, which sees the commonality of all experience. What Pandavarsini sees in with discriminating wisdom, she sees all phenomena in their uniqueness. So this kind of wisdom experiences a way in which no two moments, no two experiences are ever the same. Green Tara at the end there, probably the one that we're most familiar with. So Green Tara is in the north, and she is connected with Amoghasiddhi. And she's known for her fearless compassion and this idea that she responds in an instant to the needs of all living beings. And this is an expression of her kind of all-accomplishing wisdom. You can see she's got one foot, she's kind of stepping down. One leg is in meditation and the other is kind of stepping down into the world, ready to act for the benefit of all. So her wisdom, when it's kind of at its kind of full maturity, when it becomes so natural, so integral to her being, that all her actions are there for the benefit of all living beings. And finally, if we had this kind of in a kind of 3D way, we would have in the middle, in the centre of the mandala, tried to represent it there, is Akasha Dharteshwari, who is pure, brilliant white and is associated with the male Buddha Virochana. And her name means sovereign lady of the sphere of infinite space. And she represents the infinite space of enlightened consciousness. And this is illuminated by this kind of brilliant wisdom of enlightenment. So she embodies the wisdom of the Dhamma Dhatu, the sphere of the complete realization of the true nature of things. Hence her position in the centre of the mandala. So she kind of encompasses all the other wisdoms. So that's a very brief introduction. And I would just say that, you know, over the next few months, you know, you might kind of, or you might even today have felt like, oh, there's a kind of connection to one or another or a couple of them and so forth. And I'd kind of really invite you to kind of explore that both inside the class and outside of the class as well. You can do that in lots of different ways. You might kind of, you know, kind of reflect on the colour that she kind of represents or the particular qualities and so forth. So I'd kind of urge you, invite you to engage with these figures at both a kind of heart level as well as a head level, and just see what emerges. Just see what emerges. Be open and curious to what comes from that. And yeah, finally, just to remember that all these figures are embodiments of the enlightened mind. So they have a direct connection back to the historical living Buddha. And might be worth remembering that what the Buddha attained, we too can attain. We all have that potential within us. We all have the jewel within us. Thank you.